This is Jason from The Modern Rogue. Just wanted to say, from two idiots on the internet to two other idiots on the internet, big congrats on 200 episodes.
Welcome, Junkions, to an action-packed episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot one-liners, apparently. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast, so good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, he's a screenwriter, he's a lieutenant of Megaforce.
He's very excited to be here.
He is the action-packed C. Robert Cargill.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. This is a very special episode for a lot of different reasons that I'm very excited to get into. But if you would like to hear more exciting things, you can find our entire back catalog on iTunes as well as on Blog Talk Radio. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on the Facebooks. Facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And if you really like the show.
I mean, really like the show.
If you like the show more than Detroit loves destroying cars, you can always go to Patreon.com/ Junk Food Cinema. And for as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. And it's a great way for you to keep this show afloat. It's weird that I just mentioned the auto industry, so I'll say that again. It's a way for you to keep this show afloat. We'd really appreciate that. And this week, by the way, special shout out to you guys, because you have not only kept us afloat, you have kept us afloat for, as of tonight, exactly 200 episodes.
The deuce, you say?
We have reached our 200th episode of Junk Food Cinema.
Holy crap, we have done 200 of these fucking things.
200.
Jesus, that's two bills, man. That's crazy. It's weird, you know, it's very weird to think about, like, in terms of that. Like, it's like, you think about it in terms of, like, a career goal. Like, oh, hey, yeah. We have done 200 episodes of a thing. That is impressive. That's fantastic. We have sat together and talked about no less than 200 fucking movies.
Yeah.
That's not counting Patreon patron specials. It's not counting the episodes that were six movies.
Yeah. When you do the math, it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of like 215, 220 movies we talked about.
We spent a lot of time drinking in the same room talking about movies, and we still have a deep roster of movies we want to talk about. Like, it's not like every once in a while I just get so busy in life where I'm like, man, I don't know if I can keep doing this. You know, this is just, it's time out of my week that I don't know if I can spare it anymore. And then I'm like, but you haven't talked about this movie yet. And it's like, oh, I really want to do that. And if I quit, what would I do? I'd just end up starting another one with someone else. Like, it's just like, I would get bored and have to do it. So I was like, yeah, I'm kind of in this for a long haul.
So you heard it here first. Cargill is shopping around for another co-host for this show.
No. I'd probably start another one with you. It was just... I just, like, you know, it's so weird to think about, like, how long we've been doing it and how many places we've been doing it. You know, this podcast, this is what, the fifth venue?
It's a migrating podcast. It's like one of those progressive dinners that your church would have, except instead of roast or a good casserole, we eat nothing but Twinkies at every stop. It's incredible.
This has got to be our fifth or sixth venue that we've recorded at. Because we had the first, we were working out of a friend's broadcast office.
Yeah.
Because he had a podcasting station.
Yeah.
Then we worked out of another friend's office in the same building that was hot as balls.
Yeah, two hot closets.
And then we moved over to your sex dungeon.
My sex dungeon, correct, yes.
And then we recorded in, where we recorded the bulk of episodes, actually. The longest was probably my living room at the old house. And now we're here... in Cargill Studios.
See, I was going to call this the house on Cargill Hill because, dear Lord, that driveway and that front step are
It's a little steep.
Putting the calves to the test, but it's good. I need it after all of the amounts of double downs that I eat. So I appreciate it, if nothing else. And I think you will appreciate something that I have for you, actually. Something that I brought back with me from Convergence.
Herpes?
Yes. No, not herpes, goddammit. I have brought you a copy of your own book, so you're probably super excited about that. However, this copy of your book has been rotating around the Facebook Junkion group, and it has been, I believe, across the pond a couple of times. And as you will notice on the inside, it has been signed by a number of different listeners and fans that have at different points gotten their hands on that particular copy. So just some words of love and inspiration from various people that have had that copy. It's kind of the JFC Book Club has been this copy.
Holy
of Sea of Rush.
Shit, so, guys, this is fucking awesome.
So on our 200th episode, I thought it would be nice to
present that to you. This is great. I can't wait to dig in and read all of these. Guys.
So you're going to say to read the book. I'm like, I'm pretty sure you know how it ends.
Oh, no. I've read the book. In fact, we're just for historical sake, by the time this is posted, we'll know whether or not. But I like leave for London tomorrow morning to go to the Clark Awards to find out if this becomes an Arthur C. Clarke award-winning novel. That book is, you know, and that trip has been on my mind. So the idea that that book has been, you know, hopping back and forth across the ocean to you Junkions. Thank you guys so much. This is really special. I'm going to put this up on my bookshelf. This is going to be great. Thank you guys so much.
Fantastic. And also in honor of our 200th episode, we thought we would blow some shit up for the next couple weeks. And I don't know that there has ever been a movie that has in the first 5 minutes spoken more directly to my interest than this week's film.
But before we get there, we've got one more thing we have to do.
Oh, yes, of course.
We've got whiskey in hand. We're doing this, we are recording this on July 16th, which some of you may have just put together by the whole Clark Award thing. Today is the 1 year anniversary of losing George. You know, George Romero passed away a year ago, and film Twitter's been blowing up about him, talking all day, and there are not a lot of filmmakers that do that. He never made a huge tentpole movie. He never won an Oscar. He's not somebody that most film historians would look down and go, oh, this is truly one of those great filmmakers. And yet to the film community and to the horror community, he is. And he's one of the greats and is always going to be remembered. And so it's one of those days where it's very sad, but we want to celebrate. And being Junk Food Cinema, we're raising a glass of some nice 18-year-old Glenmorangie scotch in honor of Romero tonight. So if you have a beverage in hand, if you would raise a glass with us.
Yes.
To George.
To George.
Now, let us...
It's like drinking the inside of a Pop-Tart. It's so delicious.
It's so good.
Let's go ahead and talk about this week's movie, which is...
Action motherfucking Jackson.
That's Action Albert. Action Jackson.
Why do they call you Action anyway?
Have to catch a cab. Now I got you.
He's a cop who carries no weapon.
This Jackson is so vicious, we don't even let him have a gun.
Yeah! He's a maverick who answers to no one.
You not to let boy's arm off.
He had a spear.
He's a man who's no talk.
I bet I can make you change your mind.
And all action.
How do you like your ribs?
The indefatigable Action Jackson.
The one big fella.
Some action.
So allow me to lay my healing hands upon you. What do you want from me?
I want you to die.
When it calls for action,
Jackson!
He's the one to call.
If I was to hit you again, you'd probably slam my little body right through that wall.
I was thinking about it.
Carl Weathers is Action Jackson, and action is on the way.
That's exactly what I was gonna say.
Hey, Junk Food Cinema fans, Junkions, and all the rest. Joe Lynch here, your least favorite guest, here in lovely Cincinnati, Ohio, shooting my latest film, which hopefully will become as junk food a la mode. We all hope, we all dream. I just wanted to call and say thank you so much to Brian, to Cargill, to Merrill, to Jess for being very patient with those two, for 200 episodes of what's arguably one of my favorite podcasts of all times. Seriously, you guys have been my therapy. You've been my rock. Hearing you two every week talk and just shoot the shit about some of my favorite movies, films that I've never heard before. Actually, that's not true. I've pretty much heard of all of them. But some films that I might not have thought about watching in a long time, and then hearing how passionately you guys give the respect due it gives us all hope, both as fans and as filmmakers, that there are fans out there that like to voice how much we love these movies. And to me, you guys are as valuable a resource as IMDb and Motherless.com. So thank you very much, guys, for all the Stargroves, all the sidebars, all the mentions of Megaforce, which I'm sure Brian will get right someday. But thank you guys so much for 200 episodes. I hope we get 200 more. I kind of need it right now. I need my therapy. I need my fix, guys. Come on, so hurry up. But thank you so much for all of you, all that you guys have done. And I can't wait to hear what's on next week. So seriously, just can you post it now or send it to me early? Anyway, have a good one, guys. Gossamer, RIP.
For me, this is who Carl Weathers always is and always will be. Like, to most people, he is Apollo Creed. When they see him, it's like, oh, it's Apollo Creed. Every time Carl Weathers shows up, he is Action Jackson to me. I saw this movie in a theater. This was the movie that kind of strung it all together. We'll get into this, but for like the big holy trinity of vanity films.
Which is something you will only hear on this podcast.
Stargrove. It is a film that is really special, that ties together. I think it is the perfect 200th episode because it brings together so many other junk food favorites that we've talked about that are going to get referenced in this, because this movie is like the deranged wet dream you have after watching a bunch of our favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And this is that dream where it's like all these people from all these movies show up and you're like, wait, is that... That is, and it's gonna, I mean, we're gonna mention Stargrove and it's gonna fucking fit into tonight. Yeah. You're gonna do a certain impression that you love to do at some point. This is junk food as fuck. And if you have never, ever truly enjoyed, sat down and given Action Jackson a shot, you are missing out on one of the great fun 80s action knockoffs that just does everything you want out of an 80s action film. Like, everything is here, both good and bad. And it's a very interesting film in the way it works, and we're going to get into that. But let's talk about some Action fucking Jackson.
Let's do, and just a quick sidebar.
Sidebar! Trip to the sidebar.
I got back from Convergence recently, and there is something they do at Convergence every year called Killer Bees, where a bunch of the local writers and comics will actually watch clips from bad movies without the sound, and then there's live music provided in the room as they kind of mock it. Guess what one of the movies was this year?
Was it Action Jackson?
It was Never Too Young to Die.
Oh, well, yeah, because last year when I was after Convergence last year, I was at the after party that a friend's that's held at his friend's house every year. And a bunch of the people who do Killer Bees were over, and I mentioned Never Too Young to Die, and everybody said, what the fuck is that? And I said, I'm buying it right now. We bought it. Actually, they could not rent it through Apple. They could only buy it, so we bought it. My buddy was like, if this movie sucks, you owe me $10. I'm like, done. And we all crowded in the living room.
So you immediately gave him $10.
No, because everybody lost their fucking mind over Never Too Young to Die. They were just like, how is this a fucking movie? It's amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, everybody lost their minds, and people needed to work the next morning. And we were watching it still like 1 a.m. and people were like, I need to work in the morning, but I cannot leave. And we just kept getting people. No one left. So by the time the movie was over, the living room was full and everybody was just madly in love with this delightful piece of shit.
My favorite part of being in that room this weekend was hearing about 5 minutes into the clip, throughout the room, this sort of wave of realization of, oh, that is the guy from Full House. And I'm like, you're damn right. That is John Stamos as Lance Stargrove. Oh, motherfuckers. So just found that very amusing.
Stargrove.
To Action Jackson. And again, I want to say this. Never before has a movie in the first 5 minutes spoken so directly to my interest. This movie begins with a staunch reminder that we are in fact in the Joel Silververse by the appearance of Gail Wallins herself, not playing Gail Wallins, which is interesting, that Mary Ellen Trainer, for the first time, I think, in a Joel Silver movie, is not playing Gail Wallins. But so she's sitting there taking a meeting. It seems to be kind of some seedy stuff going on. And then enters the John Carpenter Corps, who is the only way I can think to describe these guys, because...
Wait, really? That's the only way? They're like the world's worst Def Leppard cover band.
They are, but when they first enter this room, they are not saying a word. They are all wearing glasses. They look like the guys who were sent in to take out anyone who put on the glasses and They Live.
It's weird, because the opening of this movie is so interesting. It's when you watch the opening of this film, you can tell you've got a director who's trying to say something, who's trying to evoke that he has a voice that's different. And we have this character scrambling through an office building, and we're only catching brief glimpses as the camera buzzes by the terrorists. The whole idea being, this guy is lost, he's confused, and the director wants us to be just as confused as the character is. Now, this is not always a good choice. It's a choice, but not always a good one, because you're just kind of sitting there going, what the fuck is going on right now? I'm not following along. And that's a very dangerous thing to play when you're talking about creating that, creating a film and creating that sense of confusion, that when the audience is confused, there's a point at which they stop being confused and just go, this movie doesn't make any fucking sense, and it pulls them out. So you got to play around with that. But this scene does that really well, and I think really kind of nails it. And you're just like, what the fuck is going on? And then we pan up and see this Def Leppard cover band they're really terrorists.
I wish they
look like a Def Leppard cover band.
They look great. I really wish I had a photograph of them, because holy fuck, it's incredible. And you will recognize throughout the baddies in this movie, you will recognize a lot of Joel Silver mainstayers. Now, we mentioned the director of this movie, who is himself a Junk Food Cinema alum, and it's an interesting phenomenon, because this guy's career phenomena. The phenomena to which I refer is the fact that this is a guy who came out of the gate with Action Jackson, his first feature film, and then proceeded to immediately show decline in his next two movies. And yet, both of those next two movies are totally Junk Food Cinema worthy, in so much as we've covered one and we're going to cover the other. His next two movies were I Come in Peace.
Yes.
And Stone Cold, starring Brian Bosworth and Lance Henriksen.
You keep saying we're going to cover that.
Well, I have news for you, sir. Our latest $25 per episode patron demanded that we cover that movie. So,
well, then we're covering Stone Cold.
We're
going
to cover that movie.
We will do it. Proof again that we will do anything for $25.
This is very true. We will cover the entirety of Craig R. Baxley's canon. And that is something that, again, you will only hear on Junk Food Cinema. So you are welcome.
$25 is $25.
This is very true. And then from here, we are introduced to our hero, Action Jackson.
In a wonderful way. Again, here's where, okay, I'm going to lay out the problem with this movie and the glory of this movie in one concept. Action Jackson is a terrible movie about a cliched cop and an interesting but cliched villain going through the paces of a very cliched 80s cop story.
Yes.
However, instead of making a movie about this cop and this villain, Baxley ends up making a movie about an amazing, amazing troupe of characters in this Action Jackson universe, every single one of whom is delightful. Every character in this movie that is not Jackson or Delaporte, is it Delaporte or Delaplane? Delaplane. are just weird and different and awesome in all the right ways. So when this movie opens after the terrorists kill these people who, you know,
at the beginning of the movie, we have no idea what the consequences of their lives are. Like, why were they targeted? Who knows?
Really, that whole subplot mostly gets thrown out of the movie.
Which is incredible because Mary Ellen Trainor unfortunately gets kind of unceremoniously dumped, but the guy in that scene who gets killed gets fucking killed. Like, we're talking blown out of a window with a grenade launcher and then catches fire on the way down.
Yeah, it's their incendiary grenades. Yes. So he gets blown off in fire, blasted out of a building window, falling, flaming to his death, and then smashing through a window into a fucking restaurant.
He's going to be taking damage for the next three rolls. Let's just put it that way. Like, it is a kill and a half.
So then we open up with what would ordinarily be a small throwaway part of this stupid street kid looking to steal purses. You have no idea that this character is actually going to keep showing up for the rest of the movie as a gag and then as part of the movie. Like, he fully enters the movie in the third act, inexplicably. There's really no reason for it. We'll get there. But so he gets caught by these two amazing cops played by...
One of them by Thomas F. Wilson, Biff Tannen himself.
Yes.
And the other by, who is the actor who plays the other one? Is that Roger Aaron Brown, I believe is the actor's name?
Yes, and he is a junk food alum as well. He's a guy who's been in, he's a character actor that the minute you see him, you know, he's that guy.
Yeah, in fact,
I would argue that he is essentially, blanking out his name, intro junk food for like 180 episodes.
Dick Miller.
Yeah. He is essentially the Black Dick Miller. When you go through his career, he's in that movie, and he's in that movie, and he's in that movie. Recently, he's joined the stable of Loreen Scafaria.
Here's the greatest part. I'm glad you said that. His top four on IMDb are all movies we've covered.
Yes.
They are Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, Near Dark, Cobra, and The Crazies.
Yes.
Literally his top four. We've covered all of them.
We've covered more of that.
Yes.
More than that. He is one of those guys who's shown up in fucking everything. And he's someone we don't really mention because, like, he shows up and does little bits. Here he's got much more of a substantial bit where he's the partner of Biff Tannen, police officer.
He also does a voice in Maniac Cop 2.
Yes.
What the fuck?
Yes.
You're absolutely right. I am on board for this.
Go through that IMDb list.
Yeah.
Roger Aaron Brown is... fucking in everything. He is the Dick Miller. He is the African-American Dick Miller. And
he's in The Meddler.
And the thing is when you mention, yes, when you meant, because like I said, he joined Scafaria's troupe. Like, he's one of her go-to character actors now. Probably because, A, he's probably awesome to work with, and B, when you look at his filmography, every time he shows up, it's like, oh, yeah, he's the guy that delivers that great line, or he's the guy that does this. Like, in Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, he's the guy cracking up, offering positions to people who are still there in the company. He's like, some new positions have opened up. So who wants to be chief financial officer? Like, he's always great. So these guys are driving around. So Biff Tannen is the idiot. Roger Aaron Brown is the straight man. They see this kid who's dumb as fuck about to rob somebody, and they're just having a hoot and a holler with it. These are good old-fashioned, old-school cops in the way we kind of wish all cops were, in that... they're there to protect and serve. They're watching. They're waiting. They're going to bust this kid. This kid's got it written all over his face. In fact, they joke he should be wearing a t-shirt saying, I steal shit.
Yeah.
They're just waiting. The kid ends up grabbing the wrong fucking purse, getting the shit beat out of him. They arrest him, throw him in the back of the car, and start doing a whole bit about how, oh, don't worry, you're a young offender. We're going to take you to Jackson. Now, this serves two purposes. One, they are myth building up who Action Jackson is. And two, they're really kind of busting Jackson's balls, because Jackson used to be King Dick of Shit Mountain. He used to be the king ass kicker. But we find out that for the last 2 years, he's been riding a desk. He's just a desk jockey now. He's been emasculated. He's had his stripes pulled. And he's constantly under watch by the chief. And so he's not going to fucking do anything. Like, this is, they're kind of joking with each other while scaring the shit out of the kid by the legend of
Action Jackson.
Action Jackson.
Which what they're also doing is establishing themselves as sort of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of this story.
Who they really are.
They do. Throughout the rest of this film, they just keep showing up after things have gone down.
That's the best way to put them. They are the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of Action Jackson, which kind of makes me fucking happy as shit to even say those words.
His Officer Lack's first line to Albert is Albert's having trouble saying his name, and he says, "Albert, your mother and father weren't by any chance brother and sister, were they?" Which is fucking hilarious. And yes, and they build it up. They say things like, you know, Action Jackson, some say he didn't have a mother, that researchers at NASA crafted him to be the first man to walk on the moon without a spacesuit.
Others say that his mother was raped by Bigfoot. He is their mutant progeny.
So they're just scaring the shit out of this kid.
And then from that point on, this kid keeps, for the rest of the movie, having run-ins with Action Jackson and freaking out. In the best way. Every time it happens, it's funny as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, he just keeps showing up.
Well, his first interaction is he's running away because he's scared of Action Jackson, ends up spilling a cup of coffee on, the desk of, wait a minute, that says Jackson. And
that
then
says,
they do the classic
Jackson.
The classic boop pan.
And that's, how we meet Action Jackson. This is why we went so much into the first 5 minutes of this movie, because this movie sets up its myth building. And then intros him in such a fun way, and then we get the hero shot of tracking up Carl Weathers in all his 1988 fucking glory, fucking still ripped as fuck as he was a year prior in Predator, scaring the shit out of this kid. The kid faints, and now we're into Jackson's movie.
He might actually be bigger. He looks like he ate a Predator.
He's pretty fucking huge in this
movie.
Speaking
of shit mountain, like, good God.
The thing is, there's only one scene in this movie where he's entirely shirtless, and they make sure to give him a chance to flex. We'll get to that.
Also, did you notice he is breathing really heavy just so those abs are moving in and out?
Yes.
Despite the fact that he's just standing there?
Oh, and they've sprayed him down. He's glistening.
Oh, man.
He's glistening.
Him and The Rock use the same baby oil, I tell you.
We'll get there.
We'll get to baby oil, don't you worry.
We're still an hour and a half out from that gloriousness. So, the great thing about this movie is every character we run into from this point on is wonderful. Like,
yes.
Every side character is interesting.
Whether you recognize them or not, and there will be a lot of them that you do recognize.
Oh, well, if you're an 80s film fan or a 70s film fan, there will be a lot of things you recognize. Essentially, one of the things to lay out is this is probably, I consider this last of the great blaxploitation films.
And it's kind of incredible. I feel like that's the important thing to talk about with Action Jackson is that it really does feel like the last gasp of a genre that, you know, we both really love. And it was I can't think of another Joel Silver movie that gives this much of a leading man role to a black actor. Like, it's kind of incredible that this came out the same year as Die Hard. And you have a lot of the Die Hard actors that are in this, but
oh, this is a waiting room for Die Hard. Like, you can make it. In fact, you could play a Die Hard drinking game and take a drink every time you recognize someone from Die Hard because they're all over the place.
I have a theory that a lot of the people in this movie, not just the Die Hard actors, but a lot of the people in this movie were roped into being in this movie as they came to pick up checks from Joel Silver, which is why you have people like, you know, like, by the way, you know your cast is stacked when you can keep Bill Duke on the bench, which this movie does.
Well, by the way, one of the things this movie does is reunite. Like, this is, you mentioned Die Hard. This is what happens when Die Hard and Predator fuck.
Yeah.
Because everyone in this movie that wasn't in Die Hard was in Predator.
Yeah. That's what I mean. They're all just there to pick up residual checks that Joel Silver forgot to mail them.
I disagree. I feel like this is how Joel Silver worked. Like, we make a lot of fun of Joel Silver in the show. We love Joel Silver. Like, you love doing the impression of him, and there are lots of stories about evil Joel Silver. However, the people I know that worked with him, he was one of those guys that was, as a producer, and still is, because he's still kind of around, he was a jackass to a lot of people. He did a lot of douchey Hollywood stuff. But the people who he believed in, he kept giving work to and kept getting behind. When Shane Black was on the ropes and nobody wanted to work with Shane Black anymore, Joel Silver used the cred that he got from The Matrix at Warner Brothers and said, I believe in this script by Shane Black. I want him to direct it. And they just said, all right, Joel, you're going to yell at us and you're going to play this Matrix card again and again. This is your last chance to use to play the Matrix card. Here's $15 million. Go away. Come back to us when you have a movie. They didn't interfere in that movie at all. And we got Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang out of it because Joel Silver believed in Shane Black. And
to that effect, let's not forget the fact that, I mean, Robert Downey Jr. has said himself in acceptance speeches, I guess I better thank Joel Silver. That guy's only resurrected my career like three times.
Yeah. And that is what he does. And I feel that all of these people aren't in this movie just because they showed up and got checks and like, oh, there's another check. It was like, no, here's our next movie together. And yeah, you're going to have a bit part in this, but I'm going to give you a bigger part in something else. Like that's just, you know, he's using his stable. This movie is his entire fucking stable. Everybody's fucking in this. Like the only people who aren't in this, I think, are Arnold Willis and Maria Conchita Alonso. Like everybody's Sonny Landham shows up briefly.
Yep.
Bill Duke is here. Argyle makes a brief appearance at the beginning of this film. Everybody's in this fucking movie. And that's what's kind of awesome about it. Like if you want to do a double feature of Predator and Die Hard, this is your triple feature. This is your midnight movie where you watch everyone from those movies having a blast here because everyone who's given a role in this movie fucking picks it up and runs with it and is given something meaty to deal with. The only people lacking in this movie are Carl Weathers and Craig T. Nelson. And I would argue that Craig T. Nelson actually does something really magical here, and we'll get into that. But the plot and writing for those characters is at the bottom.
Which is interesting. And by the way, another Joel Silververse connection, the writer of this movie was also the writer of Demolition Man. So again, just Silver all over the place.
Oddly enough, also the woman who gets stopped in the VW in this movie.
Great scene where they try to commandeer, where our Rosencrantz and Guildenstern characters try to commandeer, I believe it's a VW bug.
A VW bug, and the woman goes, and fuck,
she goes,
you know.
What he says is, we're commandeering your vehicle for official police business. She goes, the fuck you are, and just keeps driving.
And that is the woman who is the TV reporter in Demolition Man.
And that shot where the little girl famously goes, fuck you, lady. Oh my God, I love that scene so much. But yeah, let's get back to Craig T. Nelson for just a quick second, because Craig T. Nelson is doing something in this movie we don't normally see him do. He's playing a bad guy.
And not only is he playing a bad guy, he's playing a genuine sociopath, which is what I love about this. In the first two-thirds of this movie, he is just there. He's going over the top in the way you have a villain go over the top and doing some awful things. And he has a few choice moments. Like, there's a great moment where he murders a character and, well, let's just get into it. He murders his wife, his second wife, his manservant, whatever you want to call this guy, butler, you know.
His Cato.
His Cato has just handed him, he has cleaned his .357. And so he puts the .357 in the back of his pants, becomes some interesting tension.
Yeah.
Very interesting shots in the course of this scene.
Oh, you set the scene in black and white, and it's like classic noir. I love the way they frame
this
scene.
It's shot so well. It's done so well. The performances in that scene are great. And then he shoots his wife, and as his manservant and other guy run into the room, he tosses the gun to the manservant and says, yep, works fine.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about, by the way, that's someone we have not mentioned. Let's run through the cast for a moment, because the cast here is insane, not just in terms of the character actors, but like we talked about the wife
who's played in this movie by Sharon Stone.
Yes. So here, imagine you're a director and 4 years before you made a movie in which you cast Vanity as the sexy lead and Sharon Stone as the wife who gets it in the middle of the second act.
Yeah.
And what drunken night do you have when you go, fuck, what if I flipped that? What if Sharon Stone was the vampy, seductive singer and Vanity was the wife who gets killed.
And it seems like they're like flaunting that in Sharon Stone's face by having Vanity be such a drug addict. Like, she could have easily in the script have died of an overdose at any point, and it could have been Sharon Stone's movie, and they went, you know what? Nope.
But at the same time, it all works because what Vanity does in this movie is Vanity fucking goes for it in a way that is unreal. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what melts my brain about this movie. Rewatching this movie, like, I loved it when I saw it in a theater when I was a kid. Loved it on video multiple times. It was one of those movies I was afraid to revisit because I was like, shit, this is one of those. This is one of those that I'm going to go back and all of these great memories I have of this movie are going to get soiled in one sitting where I'm going to sit there and Mr. Screenwriter is going to tear it all apart and be like, shit, this movie's dog shit and your childhood is ruined. And instead, what I found was so much more to this movie than I noticed when I was a kid. With Vanity in particular, there reaches a point in this movie where Vanity has not gotten shot up with heroin in a while. And she starts going through withdrawal. And from that point on, Vanity as an actress and the director make a choice in which the hairstylist stops doing her hair up really well. And they stop doing her makeup up great. And in the third act of this movie, she looks tired, worn out, and played out. Now, in the beginning of this movie, we meet her as the sexy lounge singer.
Right.
What you got to know about Vanity is Vanity was, for a hot minute, the girl who was supposed to be huge. She was supposed to be the next Madonna. Prince discovered her. She was in a series of delightful B-movies, the third of which we have not done yet, which is The Last Dragon. And we will at some point do The Last Dragon. She's in The Last Dragon. She was in Never Too Young to Die, which was everybody thought was going to blow up big. And we've talked about that on that episode. And not only that episode, but talked about that on the Trick or Treat episode, because that was the movie that decided not to give a main role to. The lead singer of Kiss, Gene Simmons.
Gene Simmons
said, no, Trick or Treat is not the movie that's going to go big. The movie that's going to go big is Never Too Young to Die. Everyone believed that was a flop. And then Action Jackson was her next big thing. It was a Joel Silver movie. It's the guy who produced, you know, Predator. And here comes Die Hard. And, you know, he is hot shit. And all of his movies are gold. And it's Action Jackson. And she did that. And she did a famous Playboy spread. And that's pretty much what she's known for. And so men of a certain age remember who she is because for a moment we were told she was the most beautiful woman in the world. And they weren't really lying to us. But she did not build the career everyone thought she was going to have. Prince sold her as the next Madonna, and that didn't happen. And in fact, in this movie, she sings one of the worst songs I've ever heard in a movie.
Oh, I had the subtitles on. I still couldn't tell you what the fuck this song was about.
Distant Eyes. It's all about eyes that are very far away. The song makes not a lick of goddamn.
Really, what it's about is the Battle of Bunker Hill, where the general famously told them, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. It's a Revolutionary War song.
It really is. It's that mixed with Richard Marx, and then left to die on the side of a desert road as ZZ Top drives by. Like, that is what that song is.
Sure.
And it is not good. But she
is terrible.
She is leaving it all on the table. Like, she's doing such a really great job acting her ass off in this movie and then having the courage to be. The reason I mentioned all this is you're at that point in that career. Most actors or actresses at that point in their career would argue with the director and go, no, I'm not going to let myself be presented in a way that looks awful. Like, I need to look beautiful all the time. Right. I need to be sold as a sex symbol. That is what this is. I got to look great. And instead, she's brave enough and the director is brave enough to make the choice to let her start like wearing down. Like, by the time she walks into a bar at the end to seduce someone into coming to a meeting where you're supposed to meet Craig T. Nelson and it turns out, oh, it's not, it's Action Jackson. She just looks like she was ridden hard and left to dry wet. Like, she looks rough.
Yeah.
And I respect the fuck out of that. And this movie is filled with all these small little elements like that. This movie does not pull its punches away from the gritty reality. It wants to be both gritty and a ridiculous action film at the same time, which I feel is the hallmark of Joel Silver movies in the 80s. And this movie kind of hits it in the right way.
Well, this movie has that similar thing to Die Hard, where it's really about it's about American industry in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like, Die Hard is about America's underlying fear that all of its industries are going to be taken over by Japan. In that instance, in Die Hard, it's the tech industry, and then this movie is directly about the auto industry, but it's about a sociopath within the American auto industry that's going to destroy it because he wants... It's strange. No,
not destroy it. He wants to take over because of the political power that this particular group has.
As
Craig T. Nelson says at one point in his monologuing, he says...
you caught me monologuing!
Yes. While he's monologuing, he says in 1976, the AWA got a peanut farmer, a southern peanut farmer, elected to the highest office in the land. Never underestimate their power. He is taking over so that he can become a political power broker, so that his ring is the ring that has to get kissed by people who want to be in power. It's essentially everything that... what was his name? The guy that worked under Murdoch over at Fox.
You're going to lose me real quick.
Yeah, essentially he was the modern version of that story. Like, he was running Fox News and turning Fox News into the place where if you were a Republican and you wanted to be a senator or president, you needed to come kiss the ring there. And you needed to, he was the kingmaker. And that he used Fox News as the kingmaker place, which is what ended up becoming his downfall, which is why he had backed so many of the wrong horses and hurt so many of the wrong people that ultimately his power base eroded. And when all the the Me Too stuff happened with him, he was just out. And then of course he passed away shortly after. That's what he was looking for. He wanted to just be the industry kingmaker. He doesn't want to be president. He doesn't want to rule the world. He just wants to be powerful. And in that speech, he says some things where he reveals this character's a true sociopath.
Well, it bears mentioning, we kind of skipped over it, but the reason Action Jackson has kind of been railroaded and demoted down.
Do you want to jump into the plot? You want to hit what thin plot there here?
So
let's do this.
Action Jackson used to be, as we said, King Dick of Shit Mountain, however you eloquently put that. He has been knocked down to a desk job because of the enthusiasm he displayed busting a particularly awful criminal who just happens to be the son of Craig T. Nelson's character.
Not just an awful criminal.
Peter Delaplane.
A sexual predator.
Yeah. Awful. Yes. Very, very awful person.
I did really enjoy hearing Carl Weathers use the word predator so shortly thereafter.
Gotta hunt these predators. So this causes some friction where Craig T. Nelson uses his influence to get Carl Weathers bumped down, and he's just kind of jockeying a desk, and it's become a joke, and... they cross paths again because Carl Weathers is convinced that these murders that keep happening, one being the one we talked about from the very beginning of the movie, the next being...
delightfully fucked up.
Delightfully fucked. These guys love exploding people. This team, this Def Leppard cover band, really likes bringing the pyrotechnics. Hey, well, there you go. They are pyromaniacs, in fact. And the second person they kill on his yacht is a guy where they handcuff a bomb to his wrist and just leave. They're just like, fuck you, bye. And they blow him up. And Carl Weathers is convinced that these two guys, because they were both involved in the auto industry, there is something connecting their deaths. And of course, everyone else thinks he just needs to leave it alone. But he's convinced somehow that Craig T. Nelson is behind it, starts showing up in his life again. Getting close to...
Well, no, he's not convinced he's behind it. He doesn't know who's behind it until he gets a call from junk food alum Robert Davi.
Again, all of the Die Hard in this movie.
Acting his ass off.
Actually acting, which is weird because...
His ass off.
As much as I have liked Robert Davi in films, he's not someone I would look at and go, now that is a performer. That is someone whose craft is up to snuff.
We have liked him. We like him in a lot of movies, but Robert Davi always plays Robert Davi.
Exactly.
That's what he's doing. Here, If he's not just acting, then he's literally coked to the gills.
Yeah.
And Joel Silver just shared part of his stash and goes, here's your character, snort it, and then we're going to just shoot. He is...
I wrote your character on this mirror, and I want you to get real close in with this character and just take a good look. It's like, this is a mirror. Yeah. Everything you need to know about your character is on that mirror.
It is... He just is... paranoid and fucked up,
yeah.
And gives all the information that's needed before getting killed horribly.
Yeah.
It's funny because I watched two Robert Davi movies back to back entirely on accident. I forgot Robert Davi was in this movie, and then I watched this month's Deep Dish movie.
Yes.
That should I mention it?
No, because I still want to watch it, and I'm still excited to see it. And
I saw a Robert Davi movie that we have to do as a deep dish.
That exists.
And so it was so weird seeing him go from that to this. But here he's going for it.
Yeah.
Like, he's really going for it in this. And I do have to admit, it's weird. This movie has some very weird Republican proclivities. In this particular movie, this movie has a little bit of the racism and a little bit of the, you know, anti-liberal kind of bent to a certain degree that was prevalent in this era of filmmaking. But what I find interesting is that it's Robert Davi and Craig T. Nelson in this movie.
Right. Yeah.
Two guys who we absolutely love when they're not talking about politics.
This is true.
Wow. 200 episodes. Guys, this is... Wow, I think we're all shocked that you made it this far. I mean, I think we all assumed that by now you would have died from alcohol poisoning. But the fact that you didn't is magical and masterful. And I'm so glad I get to be a part of editing this show every week. It's been so much fun. I'm so glad that I answered Brian's call when he was looking for an editor about a year ago. And I could not be prouder of the work we all do and the work you guys do, and congratulations on reaching 200. And here is to raising my fictional glass, by the way. I don't have one. I should. I feel bad already. I'm already regretting this particular thought process. But guys, I'm raising my glass to another 200, 300 more, assuming our livers don't fail by then.
I also just want to mention, we talked about this being a very blaxploitation movie. Apparently, the idea for this movie was just Carl Weathers and Joel Silver on the set of Predator talking about how much they both loved blaxploitation movies, and that's just what it was. And in fact...
And they made a great one.
There was an Australian crew member who they asked to join the project, and he said that the crew member said, "I'm in like Action Jackson," and they're like, "That's a great title." And then they built this as a potential franchise, and I'm so bummed that we did not get an Action Jackson franchise. Apparently, there was a movie called Dangerous Passion that was released in 1990, completely unrelated except that it also stars Carl Weathers, and in some countries it was retitled Action Jackson 2.
Are those countries all named Italy?
Probably so. I would not be surprised in the least. But
quick trip to the sidebar, by the way.
Back to the sidebar.
For those of you that have not watched the Joe Bob Briggs marathon, like the Joe Bob Briggs marathon was done live. It was a bit of a clusterfuck because so many of us sat down to watch it live. The servers were unprepared for how popular, like everybody knew, oh, Joe Bob has a fan base. Nobody knew how popular that fan base was. And Shudder worked really hard to fix it. And they were all really heartbroken about, the problems people had. But all the episodes are now online and you can hop on Shudder and watch 13 great movies, half of which we've already fucking covered on Junk Food Cinema, like Tourist Trap and Hellraiser. It's a lot of great stuff. But the episode they did on demons, Joe Bob actually breaks down the history of the demons franchise and just how fucked up the entire franchise is.
Yep.
That breaks down everything we've ever talked about, how fucked up Italy is. I didn't know the full history of demons, the demons franchise. I knew demons and demons 2, and I knew there were multiples of them. I had no idea the church was supposed to be demons 3.
Oh, it's obvious when you watch it. I actually didn't know that, but when I watched the church, I was like, this feels like demons 3.
It was supposed to be demons 3, and the director was like, no, fuck these guys. Michelle this is Soare. My own movie. I'm calling it The Church. And then Demons and Demons 2 did so well that he really regretted it. But they took this other film that was completely unrelated and said, well, can we call this Demons 3? Yes, we can. Like, it goes full Italy to the point that there are now 6 Demons movies.
Yeah.
And watch the Demons episode. First of all, Demons, amazing movie. Second of all, Joe Bob fucking amazingly killing it. Third, his whole Demons thing on the history of the Demons franchise is delightfully convoluted in all the ways that we at Junk Food Cinema here approve. So that was your trip to the sidebar.
And we're back. So I just want to point out as well, in this beginning, the actor that gets blown to smither fucking reens is Edo Ross, who you'll recognize from 1,000 things. But did you happen to notice what he's watching on TV at the beginning? He's watching a boxing match.
Oh, yeah.
He's not just watching a boxing match. He's, in fact, watching the final fight of Rocky II.
I didn't catch that.
And I noticed it when I was watching it. I was like, wait a minute. Is that just... No, they wouldn't just show Rocky II with Carl Weathers as Apollo Creed and not mention it, right? Oh, no, they're doing that.
Oh, they did it.
Joel Silver, you magnificent bastard.
Dude, this movie knows that it's a blaxploitation film.
Yes.
And it does it just right. And it fills it with so many great character actors and so many great bits that it just fucking works. And little bits like that, I didn't know that. That makes it even better. Can we talk about some of our... Well, let's go back to the plot, because we still haven't fully...
The plot.
Like, there's a plot here, kind of.
This is pretty much it. I mean, it's one guy...
Craig T. Nelson has married Sharon Stone after the death of his first wife, and also has a mistress who is Vanity. So Craig T. Nelson is boning Sharon Stone and Vanity in 1988.
Keep in mind, this is the guy who 2 years before we were all in love with as one of the greatest, sweetest dads in horrordom, and is turned around and just...
6 years before.
6 years before, excuse me, yes. And all of a sudden is, by the way, the fucking dye job that they give him just to push
so
the idea
good.
That he is a douchebag. It is such a bad blonde that in certain lights, it is green.
Yes, it is not only that, but they also left his eyebrows brown.
Oh boy.
Which is gloriously 80s. It's douche-tastic.
He looks like a fucking replicant. Like, I don't even need to give him a void comp test. He's a fucking replicant.
So he is, we all know he's guilty. They've already shown us he's guilty. He's just kind of doing his thing. And Action Jackson is kind of looking into it. Kind of.
Sort of.
And then shit goes down. And he falls in with Vanity and someone tries to kill her. And they go back to hide out at her place. The place blows up. They're on the run. And now it is character actor bingo.
Oh, yeah.
Where Fats shows up.
Yeah.
Is it Fats? What's his? Chino Fats. What is his last name? He's a guy that you'd recognize, like, first of all, you'd recognize him from Weird Science. He's the guy who always talks like this.
Chino Fats Williams.
Chino Fats Williams, who every time he comes on, he's just got one of the most amazing voices God ever gave a creature on this planet. And he is,
he's Wolfman Black.
He is, and he's an ex-boxer that everybody remembers and loves for being this great ex-boxer who now runs this fucking flea bag motel where the presidential suite is the one without cockroaches.
Right.
Which I love. It has a 13-inch black and white TV. It's like, they knew what they were making. They knew what this is. This movie has so many just great tiny little in-jokes about what this is. There's this great moment where he goes to tap an informant and he goes to talk to a guy named Papa Doc, which you got to imagine maybe that guy is Jamaican. I don't know. What is the? This sounds like a very 70s thing, but it turns out Papa Doc is dead and they've got his balls in a jar. And just for asking about him, Action Jackson gets his ass whooped, has this great comedic scene where he talks his way out of it thanks to Vanity, and
which,
then
by the
turns
way,
into a fight.
By the way, Joel Silver, I see you. I see you reusing that in Die Hard with a Vengeance. P.S. The
oh,
whole,
yes.
Like, he's crazy, like Bellevue. I'm like, motherfucker, come on.
Oh, yeah.
You think I wouldn't notice you using that again in Die
Somebody
Hard with a Vengeance?
Somebody said you used that in Action Jackson. He goes, yeah, but nobody saw Action Jackson. So, that I guarantee you that's what he fucking said.
Yeah.
So they do that, and then he goes back, and Fats is just like, yeah, I could have told you Papa Doc was dead. Here's who you really need to go and talk to. And then we get a trope I have never seen done since, and I love this, that the informant he goes to is a hairstylist.
Yeah.
Where, of course, because she talks to fucking everybody and everybody runs their mouths and she knows everyone and has everyone's information. And he's like, what do I owe you? And she goes, nothing. I just want to do it to help out the legendary Action Jackson.
Which, by the way, great cheat when you're like, you know, this movie's running a little long. We need to deliver this exposition as quickly as possible. That woman,
rapid fire hairstylist, so good.
Yeah.
And she's just lovable. That entire, like, that's, that was the moment where I just, in rewatching this movie, I'm like, I love every character actor who walks onto this movie. This is a director who is just having a blast creating characters and is delivering this very 80s-tastic movie, but is having fun with every scene and working with probably some of his favorite people. Because that scene's just great. It's quick, it's in and it's out, but you love her and you can tell that they wanted to make a franchise. And what was going to happen in the first act of Action Jackson 2?
He goes back to that salon.
He needed to go get his hair did.
Which is hilarious because his hair does not move throughout 30 years of his fucking career.
No, she doesn't.
He has the same haircut in Rocky that he has in Action Jackson.
And it's glorious.
That shit don't move.
It doesn't move. It doesn't change because why change perfection,
Brian?
That is
a good point. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
I mean, fucking, I had a booth. I was at a convention a year or two ago, and I had a booth next to Carl Weathers, and it was, man, still fucking got it. The man is glorious. And it was, I was so nervous I couldn't go up and talk to him because he's fucking Action Jackson. And then sure enough, on the second day, somebody walks in with a full-size Action Jackson poster to have him sign. I'm like, yeah, motherfucker.
That's awesome. Because
everybody else was showing up with Predator stuff and Rocky stuff, and this guy shows up with Action Jackson. I'm like, that's my homie right there.
Also, we mentioned his Kato in this movie. We didn't mention who plays him. You want to talk about Joel Silver alums? You want to talk about Junk Food Cinema alums?
Yes.
The great Al Leung. Holy fucking shit. And by the way, we're kind of cheating because Action Jackson came out in February. But what that means is that it actually beat Die Hard to the box office. It beat Die Hard to theaters.
It's not cheating because really this was a summer movie if ever there was. This was not a February movie.
How the fuck do you release this in February? You want to know why no one saw this movie? Because you released it in February. This is a summer movie if I ever saw one. And you know what? If I ever saw a summer movie that didn't feature Carl Weathers running down a speeding taxi on foot, I would probably declare that movie a failure because now that I have seen that, everything that doesn't feature that is a failure to me.
This movie goes crazy in all the right ways. Like so when it's true. Not doing character scenes, it just goes bonkers, like completely bonkers. Oh, hey, let's talk about another great character who keeps showing up in this movie. The bouncer slash bodyguard.
Yes.
Who has my favorite bit of dialogue in this movie. Where Carl Weathers goes and you know exactly what scene I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Where Carl Weathers decides he needs to get into the room and the man's not letting him in. And so Carl Weathers takes some shots at him and the man doesn't flinch. And Carl Weathers is like, you're probably thinking of hitting me right now. And he goes, I was thinking about it.
He said,
but it goes against my Muslim beliefs.
Yes. He says, if I were to take another run at you, you'd probably put me through that wall. And he goes, I'm thinking about it.
Yeah. But it goes against my Muslim beliefs. And it's just in that moment, you're like, dude, I fucking love this guy. Like already he's kind of like butted heads with Craig T. Nelson. So you're already kind of like, huh, what's up with this guy? Because Craig T. Nelson's like, you do remember who pays your salary, right? And he's like, I sure do, sir.
And most generously.
Most generously.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, all right. Yeah, no, this guy knows how to kiss ass, but he's not necessarily one of the thugs. And so when he shows up later in the movie as a good guy.
Yes.
In probably arguably the worst line of dialogue in the film. That's the thing is This is like the Joss Whedon X-Men thing where he did a rewrite on X-Men and wrote both the greatest line in the movie and the worst line in the movie. For the sidebar.
Sidebar.
For those of you that are unfamiliar with what that is, Joss Whedon wrote the line, how do you know you're really you? You're a dick.
You're a dick.
And then the worst line of the movie is, do you know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning?
The same thing that happens to everything. Shut up!
So Joss Whedon's responsible for
both. Shut up, movie.
Still, I used to hold that against Joss Whedon. Having seen enough Joss Whedon movies, I know how he delivers that wry kind of dialogue. And if that line were directed by Joss Whedon, that line might be funny, but it was not. And so it was not. But yes, so all right, back to the, so he then has this moment where he jumps off another story into a fight to knock out some terrorists and help Action Jackson get out of the bind he's in. And his line is, "Hello, I'm Mr. Ed."
Yeah.
Which was big in pop culture at the time, because in 1988, Nick at Nite had just started up a year or two before. And one of the first things they used to run was Mr. Ed. And so Mr. Ed was all over the place. Like, it was... like in the late 80s, Mr. Ed and the Patty Duke Show and all of those old and God, what was the name?
The Dobie Gillis.
Dobie Gillis was one of them. And then there was God, what was the wife? The perfect wife, like not Doris Day.
Oh,
was,
Donna Reed.
Donna Reed. Yeah, Donna Reed Show. Yeah, yeah. Like, you could not get away from those shows. And so Mr. Ed was, so I guess they thought, well, the kids all know Mr. Ed these days. So hello, I'm Mr. Ed. But you're just like watching it now. It's like, what the actual fuck does that have to do with anything in this movie?
And it was still several years away from Wilbur, from Mr. Ed being a character in Beverly Hills Cop 3. So, you know, that we all had to wait for.
Oh, Wilbur, that's not a carrot. It is... God.
By the way, just to remind everyone, 200 episodes.
200 episodes of this bullshit.
Yes.
And Joe Lynch has listened to all of them almost twice.
Yes, this is a good point. You should go...
You should feel very bad about yourself, Joe Lynch.
So much wasted
There's
time.
There's like 400 hours of your life I owe you at this point.
I feel like so many angry letters to iTunes. Like, I can't get any of this time back that I wasted on junk food cinema. Meanwhile, iTunes is like, why are you sending us letters? It's 2018.
So yeah, but that guy, aside from that, he's so fucking lovable. And we get all of these characters. This movie's just fucking peppered with them. Have we missed any of these great characters?
Because
who we missed, because we, I want to get to the, because bullshit plot on the run, blah blah blah.
Miguel A. Nunez Jr. has a small part in this movie.
Oh yeah,
who you will know from Return of the Living Dead and Friday the 13th Part 5, where he's the guy who gets killed on the toilet after eating a bad gas station burrito.
Did I mention Sonny Lester already?
You did.
Okay. Yeah, he plays a drug dealer who's briefly in this. It's like, hey, oh my God. Yeah, he's briefly in this getting his ass whooped by Action Jackson.
Yeah. We mentioned Devereaux White or Argyle from Die Hard, who shows up in this movie.
Briefly. Too briefly.
Too briefly. Mary Ellen Trainer, we mentioned. Yeah, I mean, we've pretty much run down the list.
Of course, you mentioned Ali Jung is there. Also, one guy who gets only one line in one or two lines in this movie is a guy who gets only one or two lines as a terrorist in Die Hard.
Oh yeah, the guy who's the American guy they keep at the desk.
Yeah, he's also the guy with the incendiary grenade gun.
Yes.
Who, by the way, okay, so here's the other thing about this movie.
Oh, we're doing it.
We're doing it, because as much as we love this movie, every time Carl Weathers is given a one-liner to deliver, he is given the worst dog shit.
I ended up joking that this movie was a workshop for one-liners, because they would throw things out that clearly they were very proud of. They don't make a lick of fucking sense. And I don't mean that in
They're
the
not
way that
good.
And I don't mean that in the way that one-liners are traditionally cheesy. Cheesy is great. I love cheesy. I'm not lactose intolerant. Give me the cheesy all day. No, these are nonsensical one-liners.
Yeah, and sometimes even when they make sense, it's like, really? That's the best you had? And this goes for every single one-liner in this movie, except for one.
Now, it's important to point out that before we got to this line, which, by the way, when I tweeted that I was watching this movie for the first time, a lot of people tweeted back to me this particular line that I hadn't gotten to yet, so I'm like, I'm excited to see what that's all about. But this is after, hello, I'm Mr. Ed.
Yep.
This is after Carl Weathers turns a flamethrower on somebody and says, chill out.
Chill out.
because apparently he learned nothing from Arnold whatsoever on the set of Predator. Because motherfucker, that's fire. Why would you? Okay, fine. We'll let that one go. There's a couple more like that, and then we get to a callback where when they were going to burn Carl Weathers alive, they said something about a barbecue. Vaguely racist, if you ask me. No big deal. But then they turn around.
Intentionally, right? Like, this is the thing, is this movie goes full blaxploitation in the third act where there are actual references to the racism, and there's a brilliant line about racism in this movie that we'll get to in a second.
Yes. So Carl Weathers gets himself the incendiary grenade launcher and turns it upon our friend from Die Hard and says, "A barbecue, huh?
How do you like your ribs?"
And ka-bluey.
Boom. Uh-oh. And then hard cut to grilling ribs at a party.
This is the importance of an editor in your action movie, because they smash cut from that fucking guy blowing up after "how do you like your ribs" to actual ribs being cooked on a grill.
It's like it automatically, in that moment, apologizes for every terrible one-liner in the movie up to that point. Because that's the thing, is every one of the character actors don't have terrible one-liners. They've all got great dialogue, yeah. And they all fucking sell it, and they own it. Even when it's cheesy, they're fucking owning every minute of it, and they're making it funny, and they're making themselves likable. Every side character in this movie is fucking likable. Even Ali Yung, who's playing just a bad guy with half a line, I think. Fucking, you're like, oh, it's Ali Yung. I fucking love Ali Yung. Like, everybody's great. And then Carl Weathers is great. Until he's given a one-liner, and it's like the shit that Arnold wouldn't scrape off the floor. Like, it's this is the stuff that even Arnold wouldn't say in his 50 outtakes of In Commando. Like,
this is one that he didn't get to in Running Man. That's how bad they are.
It's like when you get sub-Arnold, like you get sub-sub-Arnold, like you get
sub-Arnold.
Some of these are like Batman and Robin bad.
Oh, like this is sub Arnold.
This is Batman and Robin bad at points where you're just like, and it's the only thing about the movie that doesn't work until "how do you like your ribs?"
Yeah.
Boom. Hard cut to barbecuing ribs at the party that now all of this comes together because Action Jackson is going to the party to save the day and try to prevent a murder. That, by the way, it turns out the murderer is a black guy with a mustache that's going to dress like Action Jackson so that everyone thinks it's Action Jackson. And when you think, just when you think that that's the dumbest plan ever, Craig T. Nelson leans in and says, "Most of my party guests can't tell the difference between you guys anyway." And you're like, oh.
He definitely drops the "you all
look alike." What a blaxploitation moment.
Yeah.
Holy shit, they went for it. And they do go for it, because that's the whole thing. It's like, yeah, it's a bunch of rich white people. And how rich white people are they? When we first meet them, one of them walks up to Craig T. Nelson and goes, "I'm scandalized. There was no one outside to park our car."
Fucking white people.
Fucking white people.
Fucking white people.
This movie knows exactly what it is in terms of being a blaxploitation film, and that's what's glorious about it. It's why I think it's the last of the great blaxploitation films, because it really understood blaxploitation films, and the only thing you have to apologize for in this movie is its main plot line and its one-liners. Everyone else in this movie is working their ass off in a way that they make a really, really enjoyable film. And you can't help but smile through this whole movie and through this batshit bug nuts fucking third act.
Yeah, where Carl Weathers literally drives a car. You want to talk about
Before we get there.
Oh, no.
Let's talk about the fact that just about every character actor from the movie is brought in to help at the end.
Yes.
They're all fucking there. The fucking hotel owner's there. The bodyguard's there. The thief kid we talked about 30 minutes ago, they bring him in. Why? "You remind me of a friend of mine." "Well, why didn't you just get him?" "Well, he's dead. Okay, does that kid do anything?"
No. Callbacks.
That kid's there because, again, they were trying to make a series, and that kid was probably going to be important in the next movie, and so we had to have him there. Right. But since there isn't a next movie, it doesn't make any fucking sense that he's there at all. But fucking everybody's there. It's a who's who of the characters in this movie, right down to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern finally showing up at the end. But yes, we get to the point where the car maker has his goons run down by his own car with Action Jackson driving, then driving through the rich guy's house, getting to the second floor.
I want to talk about life goals for just a second, because I've decided my goal in life is to be the type of rich where your hallways are big enough for a fucking Ferrari Testarossa to do hairpin turns.
Whoa. First of all, sidebar.
Okay.
Sidebar. We're doing a lot of sidebars today.
So many sidebars.
That is not a Ferrari Testarossa.
Oh my God.
No. This is one of the things I find amusing about this movie. This is not a nerd thing. When you actually,
I'll be the judge of that.
We see the commercials for this car on television, and it is sold as this super sports car. When we finally see it close up, it's a fucking Camaro with some shitty body mods. Like, that is a shitty 80s Camaro, late 80s Camaro. Not the cool Camaro from the 70s, not the cool Camaro from the 90s. This is when Camaros had become so shitty that only douchebags that everyone hated fucking drove them. And they give it some really crappy body mods to make it look like it's a Ferrari of some sort, and instead it's just a fucking bullshit Camaro.
Specifically, since you felt the need to step on my dick once again, it was intended to resemble, and this is from the IMDb trivia, Ferrari Testarossa coupe. And so you'll forgive me if I was fooled by the mod.
I do forgive you that you did not see the shitty Camaro with a body mod.
By the way, it's a Pontiac Fiero under there. So take the foot and remove it from the dick.
I'm just saying. Oh, Pontiac Fiero and the fucking...
Neither one of these companies are giving money to this episode, by the way. Yeah, just want to point that out. As much as we're talking about
it. I don't
think
either of those companies actually exist anymore. Remember back Pontiac doesn't.
You could probably get an 87 Testarossa pretty cheap right now. But it comes with a trunk full of cocaine. Just whenever you buy a Testarossa, that's
I would hate with. That.
It's kind of like a DeLorean. If you can,
how still- do you look? I need to go and buy a Testarossa with a trunk full of cocaine so we can finally have Joel Silver guest on our show.
I feel like that is his asking for, or at least that's in the writer for sure. And by
it's
the
like,
way,
hey, Joel, you want to come on the show? No, what the fuck? What is you have like, fuck you. No, you want to do a couple lines with us and talk into a microphone?
Yeah, he'd be all over that.
He'd be all over that. Set that up for you.
He'd be all over that, like white on cocaine.
Just let it lie there.
He'd be all over that, like white people on kale, because fucking white people.
So then we get into the final climax of this movie. And the entire movie, Action Jackson has been telling Craig T. Nelson, one of these days, you're going to piss me off. So after Action Jackson has foiled an assassination attempt and driven through a house, murdering a man and driving up the stairs in a Pontiac Fiero with a body mod to look like a Ferrari Testarossa, and then come in to find his girlfriend naked on the bed, about to be shot up with heroin, he gets into a fight with Craig T. Nelson, who we find out in a single scene earlier is actually a martial arts master.
He does a lot of spin kicks.
He does a lot of...
Even Van Damme would be like, dude, brother, tone it down. You're doing too many spin kicks.
Well, dude, how else are you going to convince audiences that Craig T. Nelson is a kung fu master without editing trickery?
Yeah, I think like, it's someone else's leg flying in from the reverse shot.
Like, clearly. Yeah. But so he beats the shit out of Action Jackson, puts Jackson through the window of the Pontiac Fiero, and then Jackson stands up and goes, all right, now I'm pissed off.
Now you piss me off.
And then we get the Action Jackson theme song.
Yeah. Which, but we didn't even, that's the one thing we didn't talk about is who does the music for this movie. Because again, Die Hard, it is Michael Kamen, but it's Michael Kamen paired with Herbie Hancock. I'm not making a joke.
No.
That's literally who does the music for this movie.
Because if you need some street cred in the 80s, you fucking go to Herbie Hancock, because Herbie Hancock was cool as fuck.
He was, but what did I tell you as soon as the Action Jackson theme song started up is, oh good, the MIDI orchestra is here, because that shit sounded like a ringtone on your Razer phone.
Oh, that was orchestra in a box, if ever I've heard it.
Yeah.
But it was funky orchestra in a box, and it's and it's like at that moment you're just like, yeah, I just
orchestra in a slap box.
I just want to watch Carl Weathers beat the shit out of Craig T. Nelson right now, and you do it to this great funky Action Jackson theme song, because now you made me mad, and bam, he whoops the shit out of him, and then they do something bold again that I love, which is they have the we both grab for our guns, we both shoot, I hit and you don't. And Vanity runs up and goes, how did he not hit you? And Jax is like, oh, he did, and pulls back his shirt. He's been fucking shot.
And it's great. She's like, are you okay? And he goes, no, I've just been shot.
And then Bill Duke walks back into the movie.
I remember, I'm in this, says Bill Duke.
And says, I want the report on my desk by morning. What do you mean morning? Did I stutter? Lieutenant?
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant. And then, of course, Biff Tanner's there and says, Lieutenant.
Is there an echo? I love Bill Duke's reaction to this doesn't feel like the character. It feels like Bill Duke talking about the bad one-liners. And like, I'm sorry, is there an echo in here? Am I missing something? By the way, speaking of our Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, something I noticed that I think underlines our theory about them. When you go to the IMDb and you look up quotes from this movie, 85% of the quotes listed are theirs.
Because
even though they're not the main characters,
they're the comic relief.
By a long shot, most of the fucking quotes from this movie come from them, apparently.
Because they're fucking funny as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, that's... I mean, the thing is this movie works. It is all about the characters. It is not a movie that, like most films, that you would watch for its plot and its main storyline. It's about watching these characters from this main storyline. It's a lot like... In fact, now that you've mentioned it, this is a lot like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, where it's really about spending time with all the other people in this movie that normally don't get that much screen time and show up. And it's like, well, what's their story? Hey, guess what? This is their story. Like that hotel clerk that the cop knows. Well, actually, yeah, he used to be a boxer and everybody loves him. And he and Joe Frazier. In fact, that's a great moment.
The rope-a-dope moment?
Well, the moment where it's like there are two great boxers that came out of here, him and Joe Frazier, Joe Frazier and then whatever his name was. And he goes, oh, well, it's nice to meet you, Joe. The look on his face is like, oh, it's so good. Yeah. Like this movie has all of these really great character moments with these small characters. So watching them all kind of come into their own by the end of the movies. Kind of fucking awesome.
Yeah, and it's like, yes, it's silly, and yes, the one-liners don't work, and yes, some of the action sequences, like, literally Carl Weathers running down a speeding taxi on foot.
Yes.
Yes, all of those things.
By the way, which they've completely set up because he used to be in track in high school.
I don't give a shit if you were on the Olympic team. Like, you can't fucking run down a speeding car.
Action Jackson is the Usain Bolt of the Action Jackson.
Even
universe.
Usain Bolt will be like, are you insane? I'm not. No, you're Usain.
Fuck you.
I get it.
Yeah. We do not speak ill of Usain on this podcast.
I'm not speaking ill. I'm making an obvious pun, sir, because that is what I do. 200 episodes in, you should fucking know this by now. No, what I'm saying is all of those things, despite all those things, it does some really great things with character. It does some really great setup work within the script, and it does some really great things cinematically as far as we mentioned the scene where Craig T. Nelson kills Sharon Stone, and there's this great moment where he's got the gun tucked in the back of his waistband.
And her hand going to hit the gun? Oh, it doesn't.
And then they cut away, and they cut back to that again, and her hands go down, but the gun's not there. Like, that is some... Oh, that's good.
It's good stuff.
That is some Maltese Falcon shit.
Oh,
like, really awesome.
And another character in this movie is a random appearance by the chemical plant from RoboCop. Because they're in
Detroit.
This is the
chemical plant where we film stuff.
Like, yeah. I'm like, oh, wait for this. This is going to melt your brain. You're like, what could possibly melt? And then that scene comes up and you were like, wait. Is that the chemical plant from Rope? Yes, it is.
This
and
is
it
really
tracks
gonna...
up, and you see the shack that blows up.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh yeah, no, yeah, this is that.
This is
and
really going to
shot from the same position as the RoboCop camera.
It's really going to melt Emil when you figure it out. But yeah, I love this movie. This is a movie that I wish I had seen 10 years ago. I'm kind of angry at myself that I hadn't, but. Holy crap, I'm so glad we got to talk about this on our 200th episode of Fucking White People.
Fucking white people talking about movies.
And that brings us to
why was that not our fucking
Well, because there aren't because name. It would literally be indistinguishable from every other podcast on the internet if we called it that. That brings us to the junk food pairing, which is a super easy one this time.
Gee, what could we possibly pair?
How do you like your junk food pairing, Cargill?
I like it with a little bit of red sauce from Mann's, which no longer exists.
That sucks. God, but, you made me sad now.
But maybe some some Terry Black's. How about some Terry Black's ribs?
Yeah.
With fucking ribs. How do you want your ribs, people? You watch this movie with some fucking ribs.
How do you like your junk food pairings? Obvious.
I want my Action Jack, Action Jack, Action Jack, Action Jack.
Track star running down cabs. Track star's running down cabs.
Baby back ribs. Barbecue sauce.
Bad one-liners. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. Thank you for joining us for the 199 that came before this.
Thank those of you that... proud few of you who have been around for the last 200 episodes that jumped in on episode one and have stuck with us ever since. Thank you guys. You are the best. You're half the reason we do this. The other half the reason is because we just like sitting in the same room and fucking talking about movies over beers. But you are the other half. Thank you for being those guys. And thank you to those who have come along the way and joined us for the ride. To those of you who have gone back and dabbled your toe into those 200 episodes. This has become... it's so interesting to go back and listen to the mess that our first few episodes were, where we were trying to find our voice and figure out what the fuck this was.
Not like now when we're high and tight the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we have an editor now.
This is true. Thank you, Meryl, for being our producer and making us sound funny even when we're not.
.com.
Dot that thing, yes. Dot running jokes all the live long day.
Stargrove.
Speaking of the funny, as Cargo mentioned, you can go back and listen to us on Blog Talk Radio as well as iTunes. And you know what I love about this show, and I'm going to continue to do it because it gives me an excuse to wrestle the TV away so that I don't have to watch The Wiggles 24/7. So thank you for giving me an excuse to say, no, babe, I'm sorry. We're going to have to.
What do you have against The Wiggles?
Oh, so much. I could write fucking books, dude. I've gone way too deep into The Wiggles. I have several different theories about what's going on with them.
I think several of The Wiggles have gone way too deep into The Wiggles.
That's true. That is, two of them got married. So that's actually very true. And why do I know that? That shit is. I'll tell you what.
Tell me about The Wiggles, Brian.
Knowing which two Wiggles are married has pushed out the space in my brain where algebra used to live. I don't know algebra anymore because I know which two Wiggles are fucking. That should not be a thing that I know. I should know more about Carl Weathers' filmography and less about The Wiggles and maybe math and change an attire if it has time. But what I'm really
isn't
saying,
there a girl in The Wiggles now?
Yeah, her name's Emma. She's one of the two that's doing the fucking. The other one's name is Lockie, which is short for Lachlan. Lachlan Gillespie. Why do I... Stop proving I know too much about The Wiggles.
Tell me about The Wiggles, Brian.
I don't want him.
I didn't know this was a thing.
Tell me about The Wiggles, George.
I didn't know this was a string I could pull and then watch you just go.
Tell me about The Wiggles, George. No, I'm not.
I feel like one of our friends where we just bring up Darren Aronofsky and then it's Darren Aronofsky.
They do the same.
I want to punch him in the dick.
The thing is they do the same five songs in three different types of skits, and then they make 30 episodes, and these people are fucking millionaires, and it baffles me.
And they're millionaires that are fucking.
They're millionaires that are fucking. You know who's not millionaires are myself and Cargill. So
don't segue into the Patreon that
so
way.
Patreon.com, if you want to make it so
bastard.
That I can buy a second TV to put in my kids' room so I never have to watch The Wiggles again, you can go to Patreon.com or, you know, diapers and food and rent and all the important stuff.
Really, diapers and food, let's be honest here.
And which you guys have helped keep him in, so
we
thank
live in
you very
America
much for
in,
doing that.
In the teens where having two jobs is just kind of expected of a dad.
Yeah.
And this is job number two.
Who's still fucking struggling to get by on two jobs. Fuck this country sometimes. But patreon.com/junkfoodcinema is a great way for you to make sure that I don't have to watch as much of The Wiggles, so do that. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter, at Massawyrm, MassaWyrm. And you can find my new book wherever you buy books, We Are Where the Nightmares Go.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BriarGuySalisbury. And again, you can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Really enjoyed all the new followers and the new input from you guys. Like, thank you so much for interacting with us online. And I just wanted to, we're going to go out with one more nice thing said about us. So here's to 200 more episodes of this fucking show. Fucking white people.
Cargill and Brian, 200 episodes. Congrats, you guys. Who would have thought you would have made it this far? It's Greg here. I'm wishing you guys a snarkless congrats on celebrating all things excellent in a truly earnest way. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be entertaining or sincere, but I wanted to thank you guys for providing the world with a shining light on forgotten classics, undiscovered gems, and just celebrating the goodness of film despite its critical or commercial successes. You guys are truly doing the Lord's work, and I couldn't be happier for your 200th episode or for the fact that for some reason you guys thought it would be a good idea to put me on the show, not just once, but several times, to spew my uninformed word garbage onto your masses. It may all seem like jocular entertainment, but I have truly appreciated being a guest on your show and getting to become better friends with you guys while speaking into a microphone. I salute you guys at episode 200 and hope to be begging you guys for more at 4. Congrats, you guys. Have a great one.